What we'll look at over these series of studies is the book of Leviticus. Now, don't all look like that. It's not nearly as bad as you think. I didn't tell anybody in advance that that's what I was going to speak on, just in case nobody turned up. But I'm not going to look at the book as some sort of crutch to study the book of Hebrews or anything like that. What I want to do is to look at the book and try to understand it as it might have been understood by the people in the era when it was first written, back in the time of Moses. They'd come out of Egypt. You remember that the people had been slaves in Egypt, and they'd come to Mount Sinai, and there God gave them his law concerning the religion, concerning how they were to live. And it was very down to earth and it was very practical. So I don't want to go off on some sort of mystical trip talking about types in the New Testament and all that. I want to look at this book and ask ourselves, what would this have meant to the people in that time? Remember that they had only just started their life as a nation. The people had been slaves in Egypt and they'd never governed themselves. And now they have to govern themselves for the first time. In Egypt, their religion was in a mess, and they didn't have anything formalized in the way of their religion, but now it had to be formalized because the nation existed. In Egypt, they were bricklayers, labourers, road diggers, carpenters and people like that, and now they were to become largely a nation of farmers. They'd never done that before. In Egypt, they lived in a very flat, sandy country, hot and dry. Now they were to live in a country of hills and valleys. And so they settled down at Sinai for 1 year, and all these issues are dealt with in the law that was given to them, and it spreads over Exodus, Leviticus and Numbers, and there's no real break between Exodus and Leviticus. In the original Hebrew Bible, all those first five books of the Bible are stuck together. They're all one. You remember that they've come to Mount Sinai in the book of Exodus, and there they are given the law concerning, first of all, the tabernacle, their central place of worship, and then the priesthood that was to officiate in that worship. That's through the end of Exodus. And then the sacrifices that were to be offered, that's the beginning of Leviticus. And then the health laws that they had for their communal life, and various other helpful tips they were given that would help them along their way as they were moving on towards the land and ultimately settling there. And then various laws and suggestions and guidelines concerning how they might live sensibly as a community. All sorts of things that we can learn from. Guidelines for God's community of people. That's what you might say it is. And I trust that as we go through, we'll find a few things for ourselves. Well, the tabernacle and the priesthood are dealt with in Exodus, so we're going to start with the sacrifices here in Leviticus. But first of all, concerning the tabernacle, that was the central place of worship. Now, it was a mobile sanctuary. It was a place that was prefabricated and could be very easily stuck together and pulled apart and transported. And so they took this mobile sanctuary with them through the bush. And wherever they stopped, they'd get out and clear the area around there, get out their sharpened sticks or shovels, whatever they had, and build a little trench, and they'd slot little building block sort of things in there, and they'd put these frames into those bases. And the whole thing was like a sort of giant Lego set, everything sort of clipped together and slotted in, and in no time they had this framework up. And then over this framework they would drape clothing, or cloth I should say, and then the whole of that was included inside a tent shaped something like this building. So from the outside it just looked like a tent, and that's what it was called, a tent or a tabernacle, same word. But inside it had these two rooms which were formed of timber frame overlaid with cloth. The front room was the larger room, and in it were three pieces of furniture. There was a lampstand to give light, there was a table on which was some bread, and there was an altar for the offering of incense. Not for offering burnt offerings, but for offering incense. No animal sacrificed in this altar, but just burning of incense. Thick smoke used to go up, prayers and homage to God. And then there was a smaller rear room, which was called the Most Holy Place. There was only one article of furniture there called the Ark of the Covenant, and that was the symbolic presence of God. The priests only could come into the holy place, and only the high priest could go into the most holy place, and then only once a year on the Great Day of Atonement. This tabernacle structure sat within a large yard, and around the outside of the yard was a fence about 2 metres high, made of fabric to stop the prying eyes of the vulgar multitude outside, peering in out of idle curiosity. And in this yard were two things. One was an altar on which all the animal sacrifices were offered, and the other was a large basin where the priests washed themselves, because offering sacrifices, as you can imagine, was a fairly messy sort of a business, so they cleaned themselves up as they went along. Well, that is basically the tabernacle. Now, the sacrifices that we're going to talk about in the opening chapters of Leviticus were offered at this tabernacle, and the priests, of course, were the officials who did the ceremony on behalf of the people who brought the offering. Now, before we go any further, let's just talk very briefly about sacrifices, because we find them repeatedly in the Old Testament. You go right back to the beginning and you find that man offered sacrifices to God. He did so for various reasons. It may have been simply to express thanks. Somebody does a job for us and we give them a gift to express our thanks. And so a sacrifice may have been an expression of thanks. It may have been an act of fellowship, because quite often they ate the meat of the sacrifice in a feast, and so they joined together having a feed. Or it could have been to symbolize forgiveness. The sinner offered an animal to die in his place and so obtain forgiveness of sin. But the important thing to notice in all these sacrifices was that from the beginning, the heart attitude of the offerer was the most important thing. You go right back to Cain and Abel. And the reason that Abel's sacrifice was accepted and Cain's was not was basically because Abel was a man who had faith, and he was in a right relationship with God. It was to Abel and his sacrifice that the Lord had respect. It was to Cain and his sacrifice that the Lord had not respect. It was to the man before his sacrifice. We are told in the book of Hebrews that Abel offered his sacrifice in faith and was accepted, and of course Cain was arrogant. His attitude was wrong. We are told in John, 1 John, that Cain was an evil man. Now, some people think that Cain's sacrifice was unacceptable because it wasn't a blood sacrifice, and Abel's sacrifice was acceptable because it was a blood sacrifice. With hindsight, we may see some significance in the different sacrifices, but basically that's not the reason why Cain's sacrifice was refused and Abel's accepted. The basic reason was that Abel was a man of faith and he offered his sacrifice in the right attitude, and Cain was not a man of faith and he offered his sacrifice in the wrong attitude. And even if Cain had offered an animal sacrifice, he still would not have been accepted, because he was a bad man and he wasn't repentant, he had no faith. And that you find consistently through the Old Testament. The prophets raged against the people of Israel. They said, you offer these sacrifices, they're correct according to the letter of the law, maybe. They are calves, they are lambs, they are goats, offered according to the letter of the law, but God still will not accept them, because you yourselves are not repentant, you have the wrong attitude of heart. That is basic, the attitude of heart of the people. I want to speak specifically of the blood sacrifices, that is, those sacrifices where animals were slaughtered. Now, the significance of the blood, of course, was the blood symbolized the life. Shed blood, therefore, symbolized death. Violent death, death taken away from the animal. The animal was killed. This is well demonstrated in the Passover, where the blood was taken and put around the door. Now, it wasn't simply that God wanted to see red colouring. That's not the significance. The point is that the blood showed that a life had been taken, that an animal had died in place of a person under judgment. So the blood was symbol of a life laid down as substitute for one under judgment. And that's the basic significance of blood throughout the Old Testament, substitutionary atoning death. Now, why was it necessary? Well, in the sacrificial system of Israel, it was necessary, of course, because man had sinned and he was under judgment of God. He was under the penalty of death. And because he was a hopeless sinner, there was nothing he could do to bring himself back to God. There was no way back to God from man's side. There was nothing man could do to forgive himself his own sin. Only God could forgive his sin. And so God provided the way back. God provided the blood of the sacrifice. We're going to find later on in Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11, God says, I give you the blood to make atonement. It is a gracious gift of God. God didn't have to give away a forgiveness, and yet in his grace he chose to. It's the complete opposite of the picture that's sometimes painted of God as if he is some dirty bully, as I've heard it said, or the butcher of the Old Testament, that type of thing, as if he loves gore and blood, and when he's seen enough animals killed, well, then maybe he'll be satisfied. That is not the picture. God didn't have to forgive anybody. We are the ones that have sinned, not God. We've broken God's laws. We have no right to forgiveness. We're the ones in the fault 100%. and yet God in his mercy and grace chooses to forgive. This is the language of grace, the language of love. God provides the way. And so he provides the way in the sacrifices. But this raises a problem, because we read in Hebrews chapter 9 that without the shedding of blood there can be no forgiveness. And then in the very next chapter we find that the blood of bulls and goats cannot take away sin. And so it looks as if those two verses are in head-on collision. How do you explain this? Well, the sacrifices obviously didn't take away sin. You don't have to be very smart to realise that. How can the blood of a goat take away a person's sin? It's pretty obvious. It's like how you're sprinkling water on somebody's head. How does that take away their sin? Quite obviously, the blood of the goat didn't take away anybody's sin. But the sacrifice had a purpose. It demonstrated how God was able to forgive and yet at the same time be just in doing so. God didn't sweep sin under the carpet. He dealt with it, and the penalty was paid, and this animal took the penalty, you might say, on behalf of the person under judgment. So that was a symbolic way of demonstrating what was happening in his forgiveness. It was like a practical demonstration, an object lesson, if you like. But the only way people were saved in Old Testament times was the same way in which they're saved in New Testament times. In fact, there's only one way anybody has ever been saved or ever will be saved, and that is by the grace of God. And we receive God's salvation by faith. We can never earn salvation. We can't offer sacrifices to get salvation. We can't keep the works of the law to get salvation. We are saved only by God's grace, and we receive that salvation by faith. And that applies to Old Testament believers or New Testament believers. Abraham, justified by faith. Noah, Moses, all these people, they were saved by faith. The blood that cleansed the sin was not the blood of the animal. There's only one blood that ever cleanses sin, and of course that's the blood of Christ, the death of Jesus Christ. Any sin that has ever been cleansed and forgiven has been forgiven and cleansed on the basis of what Jesus Christ did on the cross. That is the great atoning act for the whole of history and for the whole universe. And there's no other way in which there can be forgiveness. Now that raises a question with us. We say, well, what about these people in Old Testament times? Christ hadn't come. But that's not the point. They may not have known, but God, of course, is outside of time, and God sees everything as eternally present. God's not like us, go to sleep one night and get up the next morning and wonder what's going to happen next week. God knows everything as eternally present before him. And he knew all about Christ's death, and it was on the basis of Christ's death that he forgave any sin that's ever been forgiven. The blood of Jesus Christ is the only blood that removes sin. That's told us here in Romans chapter 3, and it's told again in Hebrews chapter 9, where it says that even the sins committed under the first covenant, as well as those under the new covenant, were equally forgiven on the basis of Christ's death. We are saved by grace, through faith, and that is the gift of God. Well, you say, well, what's the purpose of the sacrifices then? What's the purpose of the law? Well, the law was never given as a way of salvation. That's very clear in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, and all that I'm saying to you, incidentally, is expounded chapter after chapter in the book of Romans, where Paul refers to all these things. The law was given to instruct men in the way of God, to show him his sin, but it was not given as a way of salvation. Nobody was ever saved by keeping the works of the law, and it was because the Jews tried to be saved by keeping the works of the law that Paul tells us that they missed out on the salvation. The law was there to prepare the way, but only Christ really saves. Well, concerning these people in the Old Testament times, I like to think of them as people who were saved on credit. If we want to look at it from our perspective, if we can't really accommodate our vision to the fact that God sees everything eternally present before him, well, think of this illustration. Supposing it's a weekend and one of my children has an accident and he breaks his arm or something like that, and so I take him to the hospital and he gets fixed up. And the hospital says, it's going to cost you $100, and so I pay the bill. I write out a check for $100 and I get the receipt. I paid the bill. We go home. There's just one trick. I only have $15 in my bank account. Now, have I paid the bill or haven't I? Well, we can argue for a fair while on that one, I suppose. I've got a receipt to show that I have. But if the hospital takes my check to the bank, it won't be honoured. So what I do then is, first thing Monday morning, I go down to the bank and I put $100 in the bank so that when the check is presented, it's honoured. Now that is a picture, I believe, of the Old Testament. The people were forgiven, and as far as they were concerned, they were forgiven. They had the receipt, so to speak. God forgave. But the money hadn't yet been put in the bank, if you get the picture. Christ hadn't yet died as far as we're concerned, but it was on the basis of Christ's death that they were forgiven. So they were saved on credit, but the credit was good because God always knew that Jesus Christ was going to die and that his death would be efficacious to forgive sin. So all of us are saved on the same basis, the basis of Jesus Christ's death. Now, those people may not have known about Jesus Christ's death. I don't think Abraham knew about Jesus walking around the hills of Galilee and teaching people and standing before Pontius Pilate and all that. I doubt if Abraham knew all that. But he didn't have to know, because we're not saved on the basis of what we know. We're saved on the basis of faith. Our knowledge is going to depend upon the stage that God's revelation has got to. God showed so much to Noah, he showed a bit more to Abraham, he showed a bit more to Moses, he revealed a bit more to David, the Messiah, and so on. And through the Old Testament, he's progressively revealing his will and heading towards the climax in Jesus Christ. And different people were at different stages in that revelation, in that progress of history, and so their knowledge varied. But none of them were ever saved on the basis of their knowledge. If they were repentant and contrite of spirit and called on God for his mercy, God saved them because he is merciful, and he saved them on the basis of their faith. By grace they were saved through faith. Now the sacrifice could not be ignored, because the sacrifice was the way of demonstrating that faith. Now, another illustration, you and I are not saved because of our baptism or the Lord's Supper, are we? But yet, that is a way of demonstrating what we believe. We take bread and wine in the Lord's Supper. Well, we don't really believe that it's anything other than bread and wine. But it symbolizes what we are as one in Christ, united in him and remembering him. The same with our baptism. Our baptism doesn't wash away our sins. But yet the baptism demonstrates what our salvation is. Now, the sacrifices were the same. The sacrifice didn't save them, but it was a way of demonstrating their faith in God. And on the basis of faith, they were forgiven. Faith and obedience. They had to obey what the law says. The law laid down concerning the type of animal, the way it was to be offered, and they demonstrated their faith, which is always linked with obedience, by carrying out God's commands. If they didn't have faith, they could offer an exact, perfect sacrifice, and it wouldn't be accepted. The acceptance of the sacrifice depended upon the heart attitude of the believer, always. And the whole of the Old Testament is full of cases of people who offered sacrifices and were condemned because they thought they could pay God off by offering a sacrifice when actually their lives were still full of unrepented sin. So you see the picture? Without faith, it's impossible to please God. And yet the form of the sacrifice is important. I believe the form of the Lord's Supper is important. I believe the form of baptism is important. Not because the thing itself is magic, but because the thing itself demonstrates a deeper truth. And so it is with the sacrifices. The details are important, but the details aren't going to save you any more than baptism or the Lord's Supper is going to save you. It's the heart attitude of repentance and faith that will save. Well, that is a general outline. Let's now look at a few of the general requirements concerning the sacrifices. I believe that the great detail given to us here in the opening chapters of Numbers, Leviticus rather, is to show to us what is involved, or to show to those people what was involved in their forgiveness, what was involved in atonement. It also shows us something of the thoroughness that God requires. God's not slapdash, and I'm afraid that some of us in the nonconformist churches, because we don't have a lot of bells and smells and things like that, we tend to be just a little bit too slapdash at times for our own good. We think that it doesn't really matter how we do things as long as we feel good inside. Well, that's a bit to the other extreme, you see. We've got to have the right attitude, but the way things are done is important. And so here we find that God is not interested in slovenliness. You find, for example, that the animal had to have no defects. No good bringing along an animal with a broken leg and half its ears missing and its tail falling off and things like that. It had to be as near perfect as possible, because if it was going to represent the person, it had to be a fitting substitute for him. It had to be something the person owned. My own property. It was, after all, a sacrifice. And a sacrifice means it costs you something. That's what sacrifice means. It had to be something that cost the person something. But yes, God did not want to drive the person into poverty. And so you find that there were gradations, there were alternatives, depending upon the person's financial status. Look at Leviticus chapter 1, for example. In verse 3, if his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, then he shall offer a male. But if you go down to verse 10, you find if his gift is from the flock, You see, it's a smaller animal. From the herd, it's a bull or something of that nature. But from the flock, it could be a sheep or a goat. And then you get into verse 14, and here it could be birds. You see, poorer people. All the same offering, but there were allowances for people who were of lesser financial capacity. You see, God doesn't want to drive people into poverty. He's not a cruel, great ogre that sits there rejoicing in people's discomfort. And in his grace, he provides different possibilities. But always, it had to be the best available, even if it was two birds. They had to be the best possible birds, not ones with all their feathers falling out and looking pretty sick. Again, we find that salt had to be added, obviously to preserve, and then leaven or yeast was forbidden to prevent corruption, because once again, things going off and stinking wouldn't be a fitting object to have on the altar and offering to God. The general procedure. The person brought the animal here and he laid his hands on its head and confessed his sins over it. This animal is my representative dying for me. He then killed the animal. He killed the animal, incidentally. The person offering it killed the animal. Not the priest. The person himself killed it with his own hands. Fairly grisly business, which I think would have made a point that sin is a grisly business. It's a messy business. And once again, I think in our evangelical churches, perhaps we're just a little bit too soft, a bit too glib at times in our treatment of sin. It is a messy business, and the person was reminded that it cost a lot, and he had to face the hard fact of slitting that animal's throat himself. But the priest then collected the blood, and it was the priest who carried out the rituals with the blood. He got it in a basin, he splashed it around the altar, or he took it inside the tabernacle and did various things with it, or he poured it out in the ground, different rituals for different sacrifices. There was some burning in all the sacrifices. It varied from sacrifice to sacrifice, but there was always some burning, and it varied, as we'll see as we move on. And then the part of the animal that was not burnt was either eaten by the priests in a ritual meal or else eaten by the offerer and some of his friends and family. I now want to move through the first seven chapters, and we're going to look at the five categories of offerings. Don't get into the habit of referring to all offerings as burnt offerings. The burnt offering was only one of five categories. And the way it works in these seven chapters is this. In the first five chapters, you get the first five offerings. That is, the five main offerings. And then in the next two chapters, you get additional notes, which are usually for the priests. It's as if you have P.S. Priests, please take note. So chapter one will talk about the burnt offering, and it will say you do this and this and this. And then when you come to chapters 6 and 7, you get the additional notes, and it will say, priests, note this. When you take the animal to the altar, make sure the blood doesn't spill over the edge of the basin or whatever it happens to be. That's not quite in the Bible, but you get the idea. It's a sort of P.S., priests, additional notes for you. Very briefly then, the burnt offering, which is in chapter 1, it has all sorts of elements in it. It expresses thanks. It has an idea of cleansing. There's the blood ritual, as usual. Always some sort of blood ritual in these animal sacrifices. Always a little bit of burning. But with this sacrifice, the whole lot is burnt. Nothing is kept, nothing is eaten. The whole lot, animal, burnt completely on the altar. We're not told what the significance is, but I think we can guess it. From verse 9, it tells us that the priest shall burn the whole of the animal on the altar as a burnt offering. And I believe it probably symbolizes consecration, that the whole person consecrated to God. As you get in Romans chapter 12, Paul says, I beseech you, brethren, that you present your bodies as a living sacrifice, total consecration of ourselves to God. And that seems to be the sort of thing they demonstrated. It's a very graphic way of demonstrating your consecration to God. But there's an interesting point added in chapter 6, verse 9, when he speaks to the priests. In chapter 6, verse 9, he says to the priests, this is the law of the burnt offering. The law of the burnt offering is the P.S. priests, please note bit that I talked about. He says, the burnt offering shall be on the hearth upon the altar all night until the morning. And then in verse 12, he says, he shall burn wood on it every morning and it shall go on until the night. And putting that in a simple form, it means this, that there were two offerings made every day, one in the morning and one in the evening. And they are called the continual burnt offerings, and they're referred to back in the book of Exodus, about chapter 29. And these were offered on behalf of the whole nation, morning and evening, morning and evening. And the meat was laid out in such a way that it burned constantly. And then when you got to the end of the day, they put the new one on, which burned all through the night. The next morning, put another one on, burned all through the day. The continual burnt offering, morning and evening. And the message is surely very clear that this consecration that it's demonstrating is a constant thing. It's no good saying, I'm consecrated to God, I wrote it in the back of my Bible on the 4th of July 1975. It's not as if I'm consecrated to God and that's the end of it, I can go back now, watch the TV and sort of do what I wanted to do before. This consecration to God is something that's constant, morning and evening, day by day, throughout your generations. Our religious activity, in other words, is a thing that we can never neglect. It's no good saying, I did something, and had a high spot on such and such a date, and think that that's going to carry me through. The message that comes through here, very plainly, is that our religious duties are something that are upon us all the time. And really, what I'm talking about here, in these opening number of chapters, if I was to give the whole section a title, I would call it Basic Religion. That's what it's about, Basic Religion, the basics of their faith. So much for the burnt offering. That's chapter 1 in 3 minutes. We now go on to chapter 2. Chapter 2 concerns the cereal offering, in ancient versions called the meal offering. And this was an offering taken from the daily food of the people. I guess the nearest equivalent we've got is a couple of wheat bix and a handful of muesli or something like that. It was cereal, and it was taken, a handful of it, and it was burnt upon the altar. And with it went a drink offering or a wine offering. And they poured the wine over the sacrifice, and of course it burnt up with the sacrifice. The significance, once again, I think would be fairly obvious to us, that here you have people acknowledging God for their food, thanking God for the daily provisions of food and drink. It's interesting to notice that these cereal and drink offerings, or wine offerings, were never offered by themselves, always offered in conjunction with either the burnt offering or the peace offering, which we'll come to in a minute. The burnt offering symbolizing consecration, the peace offering symbolizing fellowship, indicating that consecration and fellowship are not things that are divorced from the ordinary run-of-the-mill affairs of our life, but they are part and parcel of the total life that we live. Even the daily food that we eat, even the things we do, go to work, mow the lawn, everything we do is just part of our total lives. And so that's symbolized in the offering of a small portion of the daily food along with these other sacrifices. We get too spiritual for our own good sometimes, and we think that anything to do with spirituality is all very spiritual and holy, and then we somehow can't relate this to the nitty-gritty of eating meals and concreting the front driveway and mowing the church lawn and things like that. This tells us that our religious activities are to be concerned with every aspect of our lives. The basic religion, you see, again, penetrates all these everyday aspects. Well, that's chapter 2 in 1.5 minutes. We're doing quite well. Chapter 3, the peace offering, or if you like, the fellowship offering, as it's translated in the Good News Bible, and a very apt translation because that's exactly what it means, peace or fellowship. This was the most popular of all the offerings for the very obvious reason that a meal went with it. First of all, however, the Lord's portion was offered. You'll notice this is another consistent feature in the offerings. Always a bit was offered to the Lord first. A sort of mini burnt offering. Some of the gizzards around the inner parts of the animal, the fat and the liver and things like that. The things that were closest to the life, the heart and life perpetuating organs of the animal. These were first of all taken, and they were burnt as a token burnt offering to God. And then the priest got part of the deal. He got some of the parts of the animal, and these are put in the hands, and they are waved up like this before God, as if you get a great big steak in your hands and you wave it up like this in symbolic offering to God, and then he handed it over to the priest. That was their portion. That's fair enough. The Lord's servants get paid for what they do, and so the priest got his meals in that way. That was one of the ways the priests got their food provisions. And then the rest of the animal belonged to the offerer, and he could then take it off and have a meal with his friends. And he had to have a meal with other people. In fact, it says that he was to invite his neighbours and the poor to share with him, because it was fellowship, you see. We're very selfish, most of us. We like to enjoy our good things to ourselves and stiff cheese for those people that aren't quite so well off. Well, we've got to remind ourselves that no man is an island, and we've got to be much more mindful of these other people. And here's a good demonstration in the peace offering. He was not allowed to eat it alone, always in fellowship with friends and the poor. An interesting point in chapter 7 that's rather, I think, worth noting It says that in verse 15 that the flesh of the sacrifice of the peace offerings for thanksgiving was to be eaten on the day, and none was to be left until the morning. But in verse 16 it says, if the offering was for a vow, that's a votive offering, or a free will offering, then the time to eat the meat was extended to a second day. Anything left over after the second day had to be destroyed, because they didn't want the meat going off. They had no refrigeration in those days, and it wouldn't be fitting again for the sacrificial meat to go bad. In the case of the thanksgiving, it was all to be eaten in one day. And the reason I think that it's extended a second day for the vow and the free will is that the vow and the free will offering would have been more personal affairs. Whereas the thanksgiving offering is a general beano, and you invite many, many people along, and of course they can get rid of all that food rather efficiently inside one day. But if it's a more private affair, the number of people participating is fewer, and so you get that extension. Just one of those interesting little sidelights there. But these sacrifices were meant to have meaning for the people. I don't find deep mystical significance in lots of these details. But then the Bible wasn't written just for me, you see. It was written for other people as well, and to these people it had great importance, because they were the ones who were really involved in the offering of those sacrifices. And yet at the same time, I hope we get a few lessons by the way, lessons of fellowship and not being selfish. We need to be reminded of those things. Coming now to the chapter 4, we have the sin offering. Now this was very important, because it was compulsory wherever there had been known sin. In the case of the burnt offering and the peace offering, they were voluntary. Nobody forced you to offer those. But in the case of the sin offering, it was compulsory wherever a person realized that he has sinned. However, it was only for unwitting sin, we find in verse 2. Not for high-handed sin, not for deliberate sin, only for unwitting sin. We'll come to that later on. For example, a person had neglected to do something, or he'd forgotten to do something, and he found out later on that he had unintentionally broken his word, or been guilty of somebody losing out in some way or other. He was to offer a sacrifice for his sin. Notice the procedure. Again, the mini burnt offering, God's portion first. Always God comes first, you see. That's the lesson for us as well. And then we have two special features, and that is the treatment of the blood and the treatment of the carcass. It sounds complicated, but what I'm going to say, but it's not really as complicated as you might think. There are two categories, and in these two categories, the treatment of the blood and the carcass is different. Firstly, in the case of the sin of the high priest, or of the nation as a whole, of which the high priest is a part, the blood of the sacrificial animal was taken inside the tent and sprinkled at the veil which separated the two rooms, because that was as close as the priest ever got to God, except for the Day of Atonement, which is rather special. We'll talk about that later. But in the normal course of events, the nearest the priest ever got to God was when he stood at the veil at the end of that first room, beside the altar of incense, and of course behind the veil was the symbolic presence of God. So he sprinkled the blood there at the veil. And the animal's carcass was then taken outside into the bush and burnt. That's the first category, the sin of the high priest. Now in the case of the sin of the people, the common people like you and me, the closest we ever got to God was at the altar out in the yard, out in the open air, the altar of burnt offering. So the blood was applied there, where we could see it happening in front of our eyes. And then the carcass was taken and the priest ate it in a ritual meal. This gives rise to a couple of rules of thumb. The basic law was that a person could not eat a sacrifice which was offered for his own sin. And that's reasonable when you think of it, isn't it? Why should you benefit in a nice meal when you're offering the sacrifice for your own sin? So you see, the priest couldn't eat the sacrifice that was offered for his own sin. He took the carcass outside and burnt it. But when it was offered for the people's sin, well, the priest could eat it. The people who offered it couldn't eat it, but the priest was allowed to eat it. So the rule of thumb is this. If the blood was taken inside the tent, the carcass of the animal was burnt, not eaten. But if the blood was not taken into the tent, then the carcass of the animal was eaten, not burnt. Chapter 6, verse 30 just summarizes that. We might look at that. because it plays an important part in the story that's to occur in our next study. Last verse of chapter 6, "No sin offering shall be eaten from which any blood is brought into the tent of meeting to make atonement in the holy place. It shall be burned with fire." So that's the rule of thumb. Just a couple of points here concerning the sin offering. There were various grades of sin offering. For example, in chapter 4, verse 3, "If it is the anointed priest who sins," now he's the top of the nation, he's the top man, the priest, he's above all the civilian rulers, the priest is on the top of the stack. "If it's the appointed priest who sins," then later on in the verse, "he brings a young bull." That's quite a sizable animal. You go down through the ranks, and in verse 22, now you come to the civil ruler, and if he sins, then in verse 23, end of the verse, he brings a male goat. You come down to the common people in verse 27. That's us again. "And if any of the common people sins," then at the end of verse 28, he brings a female goat. Female goat, of course, is not as expensive as a male goat. And then verse 32, a little bit further down, he can bring a lamb, which is a baby animal, a female lamb. You see, he's not quite as well shod, we would say. He doesn't quite have the wherewithal to afford a more expensive animal. So he brings a lamb instead. But if you come to chapter 5, verse 7, supposing he can't afford a lamb. Well, it says if he can't afford a lamb, then he brings two birds. One bird for the sin offering part and one bird for the burnt offering part. But supposing he's absolutely destitute and he can't even afford a couple of birds. Well, you come down to verse 11. If he can't afford two birds, then he shall bring fine flour, and he won't put any oil or frankincense on it. Just offer it as it is plain. No sense trying to pretty it up, putting hundreds and thousands on little coloured flowers and things like that. Just plain. Because after all, God doesn't need to be impressed with the sacrifice. God is not hungry. He doesn't need the food to eat. God doesn't benefit from these sacrifices. So just take the flour. That's the least you can afford. You're absolutely destitute. And don't pretty it up in any way, because after all, your forgiveness, he says, still only depends upon the grace of God. We have no right to demand forgiveness. God in his grace forgives. And the sacrifices were the way of approaching God and demonstrating our faith and trust. One other point there is that you notice it's a non-blood sacrifice, which comes as a shock to some people, but it is a bloodless sacrifice, although I think we should also mention that when it was put on the altar, it would have mixed with the blood of the sacrifice that was burning there continually, so maybe it gained some efficacy from the blood in that way. We're not quite sure, but there it is. All right, that brings us now to our final sacrifice, which is the guilt offering, otherwise known as the trespass offering. And this offering was made for sins which could be measured. That's the way I like to put it, sins which could be measured. It was the same as the sin offering for a private citizen, except that there were no gradations. And why a sin that can be measured, I mean, supposing I forgot to pay my tithes, or supposing I forgot to offer my firstlings to the Lord. You can measure the sin because you know the amount that you've dipped out on. So the person had to make restitution. If I'd forgotten to pay my tithes, and they're worth, let us say, $100, I had to pay the amount, $100, plus a fine of 20%, and offer the sacrifice. And again, a very good point, because in this day of grace, we say to ourselves, you ask forgiveness and God gives it. And again, I think we let ourselves off too lightly. And here we find that forgiveness was not pat, but that there was this penalty, this additional reminder to the person that although he had made restitution, simply making restitution is not enough. We tend to think that it is, I've said I'm sorry, that's okay. No. Think of the damage that has been done. Think of the inconvenience you've caused the other person. Think of all the other things. And so another 20% fine is added to it. Another very practical little demonstration of the seriousness of sin. And I think it's something that we can learn a lesson from ourselves. You notice the references here in chapter 5, verse 15, he sins in relation to the holy things of the Lord. Now, the holy things of the Lord would, of course, be some of the matters we're talking about, tithes and firstlings and requirements upon the people, and he sinned in this way. He makes a guilt offering, and in verse 16 he also makes restitution of the damage he has done, and at the end of the verse he adds a fifth to it. You come down to chapter 6 and you find various things referred to there, such as he has unwittingly deceived his neighbour, he has mislaid something that a person left for him to look after, all accidental sins, you might say. But even though they're accidental sins, they still have to be paid for. Which leads me now to my final point. We've really considered all those five sacrifices, and we've looked at the first seven chapters. Just to conclude, what about the willful sins? That's the question. The willful sins are the ones that most trouble us, and yet the sacrificial system didn't cater for them. The sacrificial system catered only for unintentional sins. Now, we would think that the unintentional sins are the most excusable, and it's the willful ones that worry us. But the sacrifices are only for the unintentional ones. What about the willful sins? No sacrifice is available for them. Because if there was a sacrifice available for willful sins, you can well imagine how it would be abused. It would cheapen the whole thing. If forgiveness was so mechanical as that, well, then the whole sacrificial system would have defeated its own purpose. Remember, the sinner has no right to forgiveness. It is only in God's mercy that he's forgiven. And yet, in spite of all that, the sacrifices still had a purpose. They still had a use. They still had a meaning. Even a person who had sinned willfully could still offer a sin offering or a guilt offering or some other offering and still use that as a means of access to God, as a way of demonstrating his repentance or his faith, but he was still aware of the fact that there was no sin, I beg your pardon, there was no offering made available for willful sin. All he could do was cast himself entirely upon the mercy of God. That's all we can do. There's no mechanical way of getting forgiveness. We can simply cast ourselves upon God's mercy. Now, that's what David did in the case of his sin with Bathsheba. He says, "Have mercy upon me, O Lord, according to thy steadfast love. Wash me from my iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin." He goes on to say this. He says, "You have no delight in sacrifice. Were I to give a burnt offering, you wouldn't be pleased," because the burnt offering wasn't available for the willful sin that David had committed. And so he said, there's no sacrifice that I can offer to get forgiveness. The only sacrifice, he says in verse 17 of Psalm 51, is the broken spirit. "And I know that a broken and a contrite heart, O God, you will not despise." Now that's it, isn't it? That all we can do, ultimately, is cast ourselves upon the unfailing mercy of God. Any system that guarantees automatic absolution of sin through the carrying out of some mechanical act is obviously not of God. The whole point of the sacrificial system was to show the horror of sin and to show that the problem of sin was too deep for it to cure. The blood of bulls and goats could not take away sin. That was the whole point of it. Although it had a meaning of providing a person with a way of demonstrating his faith, a way of approach to God, at the same time it showed that the problem was so deeply ingrained, so deep-seated, that it was really beyond the scope of the sacrifices to heal it. Always the sacrifices point to something higher. They point, first of all, to the mercy of God, and ultimately, of course, they point to Jesus Christ. And I quoted earlier from Hebrews chapter 9, verse 15, where it says that the sins, whether under the first covenant or the second covenant, were forgiven on the same basis, namely the death of Christ. In Romans chapter 3, end of the chapter, Paul says the same thing. God has put forth Jesus Christ as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith. And this is to show God's righteousness, because in his divine forbearance he has passed over former sins, that is of the previous era, the Old Testament era, and to prove at the present time in the New Testament era, likewise, that he himself is righteous when he justifies those who have faith in Jesus. Again, Jesus Christ's death, that's the propitiation, that's the thing that satisfies God's justice against sin. And whether it's the former era or the latter era, again, it comes down to the work of Jesus Christ, that is the sole basis of our salvation. Well, there it is, a brief run through the sacrifices, and I hope that we've seen something of the meaning for the Israelites. I hope that we've got a few lessons for ourselves, and I hope also that it has enhanced our appreciation of the work of Jesus Christ on our behalf.